It is quite different from this world, because it's not illumined by sun, moon, or electricity. Like if someone turned the sun off, then we'd be in complete darkness. Now in the spiritual world, there is no sun. Everything is self-effulgent. Everything. In the palace of Nanda Maharaj, they don't have, you know, electric like chandeliers or light fittings. They don't even have candles or oil lamps. They just have gems in the walls and in the ceiling. And those gems are effulgent. And they light up everything. Actually, they even used to have gems like that here on this planet, but unfortunately, no longer. So, verse 6 then is giving a very brief description of what is that real tree. The real tree. It's such an amazing place that everything is self-effulgent, and when you go there, you don't have to come back to this place, to the reflection, where things look very good, but they aren't very good. Then, according to Vishnu Chakravarti Thakura, Krishna says that supreme abode is mine. It's mine. Tad dharma paramam mama. And just as that supreme abode is mine, so also all the living entities are also mine. And he speaks verse 7. Verse 7 is... It's actually an important verse for defeating the Mayavadis and impersonalists. Because Krishna says, Mam Eva Angs. Mam means my, Eva means certainly, definitely, Angs. Fragmental parts. Fragments. And they are fragments, Sanatana, eternally. So we are eternal fragments. A fragment means a unit. So we are eternal units, each one of us. Not as the impersonalist thing, that at this point in time we appear to be individual units, but on a higher platform, we're not. We're part of, it's just one. No. We're eternal fragments. We're eternal individuals. But we have a serious problem, that due to conditioned life, we are struggling. We're undergoing so many difficulties. So then in verses 8 and 9, Krishna explains our struggling, the struggling of the conditioned soul. I'm actually following a slightly different pattern to what is in your own view. It's basically the same, I guess, but slightly different. So 8 and 9, Krishna is describing our struggling position. Just as air is passing along, air is moving, the wind is moving. And as it moves, it crosses different types of situations. It crosses a very nice garden. And then it picks up the fragrance. Then the same air moves on a little further, and it crosses a rubbish heap or a sewerage or something, and it picks up the odor of that. Now it's the same air. The same air is moving around. But in one situation we may think, oh, the air smells very nice. But then in another situation, the same air, we think, oh, the air smells terrible. But it's the same air moving around. So similarly, we are moving around in this material world. And due to our association with these different situations, we temporarily pick up their nature. But then we and other people identify us according to those temporarily picked up natures. So we accept one situation, we leave it, and accept another, and leave it, and accept another, and leave it. That each time we think, oh, this is me. But it's not. One devotee gave a nice example. that now we are in these bodies, and generally we think that, yes, this is me, I am a white man, you're an Indian woman, and this is a dog, this is a cat, and big and small, and so on, according to the body. So, in your last life, who would like to be a volunteer? Dhruva. In his last life, Dhruva may have been a white woman, for argument's sake. He might have been. So if we show Dhruva a photograph of that white woman, he was the same person, same soul, and say, oh, this is you. And he'll say, no, this is not me. This is not me. This is me. But if you were to show the white woman, somehow or other, the photo of Dhruva, and say, this is you, then she'll say, no, 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 this is not me. I'm a white woman. So who is really the person, the white woman or Dhruva as an Indian man? Neither. Neither. But in each situation we think, oh, this is definitely me. This is definitely me. And I'm not someone else. And if you suggest I am, then that's completely wrong. So it's like that. We're moving around in the material world, picking up the different natures, and identifying and being identified according to those natures we pick up temporarily. So in verse 9, Krishna says that in those different situations, you enjoy different sets of sense objects. According to your particular body now, certain sense objects look very nice, but other sense objects don't look very nice. Sometimes we give the example, like, say, of a rhinoceros or a hippopotamus. I'm sure the male hippopotamus finds the female hippopotamus very nice. But we think, you know, that this is just some crazy looking animal. And he looks at us and thinks, oh, what are these human beings? They don't appreciate my beautiful hippopotamus wife. So according to your particular set of senses, you identify certain things as being very nice. But then when you have another set of senses and another body, then those same things, they don't look very nice. So it's all very relative. So this is Krishna now explaining our struggling position. Then, in verses 10 and 11, Krishna is explaining how, if you have this knowledge means the knowledge we got in chapter 13, Prakriti Purusha, Kshetra, Kshetrajna, Jnanam and Jnayam, the knowledge we got in chapter 14 about the modes of nature, and now the knowledge we've got about the banyan tree, the material world as being a reflection of the real banyan tree, the real existence, then you can understand how all these things are working. But the foolish people can't, because, as we said, when you're stuck in the middle of the forest, you can't see the forest for the trees. You get caught up in your particular situation, and you can't see the overall situation. But those who are in knowledge, they can actually see the overall situation. In verse 11, Krishna says that the devotees who have this knowledge, they can see it all very clearly. It's not a problem. For those whose minds are not developed, they can't. So then, according to Srila Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, Krishna, Arjuna asks Krishna, then what can these people do? What can they do? And Krishna says, well, I can tell you some ways in which they can see me. I can give them some hints how they can see me within this material world, and that will help them to come to this platform of real knowledge. Then Krishna speaks verses 12, 13, 14, and even the first half of verse 15. These verses, a very nice description. very similar to descriptions we've read already in other parts of Bhagavad Gita, of how we can see Krishna in the material world. These are all very important things. The sun, the moon, fire, very important. Verse 13 is talking about Krishna's explaining how food comes from him. As the moon, he supplies the juice of life to all the vegetables. And then it's because people in general, they're very attached to eating. So now they can understand, they can relate their eating to Krishna. And verse 14 is explaining about the process of digesting your food. So the food is coming from Krishna, and even the process of digestion is coming from Krishna. So eating, as we said, is an activity that people are very attached to. They're very concerned about their eating. So now they can relate their eating to Krishna, including even the process of digestion. Then in verse 15, Krishna explains that I'm there in everyone's heart and I'm supplying remembrance, knowledge and forgetfulness. Srila Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur explains that the remembrance means to remember their previous desires. As they go into their next body, they remember their previous desires. So they then carry on from the position they left off from in their previous lifetime. Even Prabhupada explained, when you wake up in the morning, the super soul reminds you who you are, where you are, and what is your business in life. The super soul didn't remind you when you woke up in the morning. Then you wouldn't know who you were. You wouldn't know where you were. You wouldn't know what your business in life was. But it's just simply the kindness of the super soul that he reminds you. Knowledge means how to fulfill those desires. And forgetfulness means how to forget Krishna. Of course, we can also take it in so many ways. Krishna can give us remembrance of him and forgetfulness of the material world and knowledge about him. So now, right at the beginning of the chapter, so let's go back to verse 1 for a minute. Krishna, in verse 1, said that if you know this tree, then you know the Vedas. In other words, all this knowledge, it all has its basis in the Vedas. It's not that Krishna is just whimsically giving his own ideas, even if he is God. But he's just saying what he feels like saying. No. He's simply presenting the message of the Vedas, actually. The Vedas are describing the material world in these terms and the different processes of advancement in the same terms that we've read of them in Bhagavad Gita. So now Krishna says that if you study the Vedas, then all that there is to be known is me. In fact, I'm the person who got the Vedas together. I compiled them. And I'm the person who really understands them. So if you want to understand them, then you have to get your understanding from me. Then Arjuna asks Krishna that, seeing you know so much about the Vedas, perhaps you can tell me briefly, what is the real message of the Vedas? And then Krishna says, sure, I can do that. That's very easy. In fact, it's so easy. I'll explain to you the whole message of the Vedas in 3 verses. Then Krishna speaks verses 16, 17, and 18. You may see this rather mysterious heading here in your overview book. Section D, the 3 Shloka Bhagavad Gita. What on earth is that? Well, that's verses 16, 17, and 18. Krishna says that these 3 verses contain the essential message of all the Vedas. So what is that? First of all, verse 16. What is it describing? We'll come on to that. Not Sambhagat. The Jiva. What is the Jiva? Who are the Jivas? There are two categories. The conditioned and the liberated. So, first of all, the Jivas. Then verse 17, Supasum. The Supreme Lord, the imperishable Lord Himself, who has entered the three worlds and is maintaining them. Who is that? That's the Supasum. By Supasoul we mean not just Kshira Dakshaya Vishnu within our hearts, but we also include Garbha Dakshaya Vishnu and Mahavishnu. They're all three forms of the same person. Mahavishnu is the Supasoul of the entire material creation. Garbha Dakshaya Vishnu is the Supasoul of each universe. And Kshira Dakshaya Vishnu is the Supasoul in every atom or within everyone's heart. So that's the second essential truth of the Vedas. And the third and last is the Supreme Person, Purushottama. This chapter, after all, is known as Purushottama Yoga, the yoga of the Supreme Person. So in essence, this is it. Krishna, he is the greatest. And he is the Supreme Person, Purushottama, not just Paramatma. Paramatma is described in verse 17. Paramatmate Yudharita. So here now in verse 18, we're hearing about Bhagavan, the original Supreme Personality of Godhead. So that is Bhagavad Gita in three verses. The Vedas, rather. The Vedic scriptures in three verses, describing the Jivas, liberated and conditioned, Supasoul, and Bhagavan. Then 19, Krishna explains that if you know me, then you know everything. And if you know me properly, then you'll naturally become inspired to perform pure devotional service. And in the last verse, verse 20, Krishna says that what I've just told you is the most confidential part of the Vedas. Anyone who understands this will become wise, and their endeavors will know perfection. Now, so that's the end of chapter 15. Now to get into it on a slightly more subtle level, let us turn back to verse 15. This is going to give a different perspective on these same verses, verse 16 to verse 20. Now look on page 731, the purport there. The fifth line from the bottom, Prabhupada says, one can attain perfection in three stages. So first of all, by understanding Vedic literature, one can understand his relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So what is that? That is Sambandha. Then, by performing the different processes, one can approach him. So what is that? That is Abhideya. And, at the end, one can attain the supreme goal. What is that? Prayojana. So now let's have another look at these same five verses. 16 to 20, in terms of Sambandha, Abhideya, and Prayojana. So 16, 17, and 18 are Sambandha, knowledge about the relationship. There are two classes of living beings, or jivas. Then there's the Supasoul, who's maintaining the three worlds and the jivas in the three worlds. And then, above all of them, the greatest is the Supreme Person. So this is Sambandha. generally, as we mentioned, I think, yesterday, Sambandha is given more emphasis than, I mean, at least in terms of quantity of knowledge. Because at least for those who are coming from the conditioned platform, it's essential to get your Sambandha correct. Otherwise, all your other attempts from that point on will tend to be rather distorted. Then verse 19 is about Abhideya, the process. That when you understand the Sambandha, then you engage in full devotional service on the basis of the Sambandha. Now that you know those things. Then verse 20, Krishna says that on the basis of all that, your endeavors will know perfection. You'll come to the perfection of life. So, these are very nice ways. Perfection of life, of course, means prayojana, the goal of life, love of God, achieved through the process of devotional service on the basis of Sambandha Jnana. So this is the yoga of the Supreme Person. Any questions? Prabhupada's purports, he talks on it in both terms. In Brahmaloka, which is the highest level of material existence, or in the total material substance, the root is there. Well, let's have a look at the purport where Prabhupada talks about it. Well, page 712. Purport there, sort of about a quarter of the way down. The tree's roots grow upward because they begin from where Brahma is located. No, Brahma is the source of the material realm. There's meaning more in that sense. Brahma is the source of the material realm. Then, if you go down about halfway down the page, Prabhupada says the root of this material existence grows upward. This means that it begins from the total material substance or from the topmost planet of the universe. Because everything is coming from there. That's basically the idea. It's rooted like in the fundamental part of material existence. That's basically the idea. Not necessarily the Mahatattva as such, but like in matter. Definitely there's no dependency. It's a fact there is day and night. It's all going on by the arrangement of the Lord. But there's definitely no dependency on a sun or a moon. Yeah. There's no dependency on a sun or a moon. Intention. Yeah. Sorry? Envy. Oh, yeah. There's spiritual envy. Oh, yes. Definitely. You know, there's a story in Nectar of Devotion. I'm sure some of you are familiar with it. That, one gopi had just had gopi dots put on her face by Krishna. very nicely. Krishna did a, the most artistic job you can imagine. Beautiful patterns and everything. So one other gopi came and looked at this, these beautiful decorations on that first gopi's face and said, "Oh, who did this?" And the first gopi said, "Krishna." Then the second gopi said, "Well, you're not very beautiful. I can tell you're not very beautiful. Because Krishna, when he put these dots on your face, he must have been standing so close to you. But he did these dots so perfectly. There's no mistake. So that means that he wasn't disturbed by your beauty." If it had been me, because, she was thinking that I'm more beautiful, then there would be, bits and pieces, because Krishna wouldn't have been able to concentrate. So that's transcendental envy. But then again, we understand that the second gopi, that envy was not like, I'm better looking than you. That's type of envy. But the second gopi was thinking, oh, Krishna wasn't very pleased. Krishna wasn't really feeling like ecstatic or overwhelmed with pleasure through associating with this gopi. And the reason is that we can see that the decorations were done so perfectly. Because they take it when Krishna's attracted to them, they can see, oh, Krishna's pleased, that's very good. So it was more like that concern that Krishna wasn't pleased by the association of that first gopi. But still, it's considered to be transcendental envy. Well, envy of Krishna is not there in, well, there's definitely no material envy. But there's spiritual envy. Material envy is the perverted reflection of spiritual envy. There's spiritual greed. Greed is generally understood in material life to be a very bad quality. But practically the main qualification for entering into the pastimes of Krishna is to have spiritual greed. Well, lust is the direct perverted reflection of love. Lust is the direct. Lust in the form particularly of attraction between male and female. But envy, there are so many spiritual, psychological, so many features of spiritual psychology. Envy, greed, anger, all these things are there. But in the spiritual realm, they're completely pure and Krishna conscious. But in the material realm, they're perverted. And they look very ugly. Extremely ugly, actually. Very bad. But otherwise, in principle, everything is there in the spiritual realm. That's about it. And pure. Yes. Well, the ground, desire is also the ground of the spiritual tree or the spiritual manifestation also. But that means pure desire to serve Krishna. But when that pure desire to serve Krishna becomes perverted, then you get this perverted tree growing from it. So you change the design. The key is to change the design. Any other question? Well, it's for anyone really, but Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur says that Krishna is specifically presenting this to help those struggling conditioned souls to be able to relate to him and then, you know, enter the Supreme Kingdom and get this vision, the correct vision of things, like that. Yeah, that's the specific reason it's presented. So perhaps we can go on to chapter 16. The divine and demoniac natures. Mainly, actually, it's describing the demoniac nature. Because we've heard chapter 13, mainly actually is describing the demoniac nature. Because we've heard chapter 13, we all know what that's about. Chapter 14, the modes. Now we heard about the banyan tree. So what does it do to a person? What does it do to someone if they get caught up in this whole scene here in the material world? What does it do to them? They become demons. Demons are not very nice, as we'll see. Demon means like a dedicated materialist, staunch enthusiast for material life. So in the first three verses, Krishna describes the devotees, or the qualities of the devotees. So many nice qualities of them. And in many ways, they're qualities of the mode of goodness. They're divine qualities, very nice qualities. They'll help one advance in Krishna consciousness. Then in verse 4, Krishna begins to introduce the demoniac qualities. They're very nasty. Pride, arrogance, conceit, anger, harshness, ignorance. In verse 5, Krishna gives a little reassurance to Arjuna, don't worry. Maybe Arjuna was getting into anxiety, am I a devotee or a demon? Don't worry, you're a devotee. You have these divine qualities in you. You know, there's a saying that in such a yuga, the demons and devotees, I forget exactly how it goes, it's something like they were living on different planets. In Treta Yuga, they're living in the same planets, but in different countries. In Dwapara Yuga, they're living in the same countries, but in different houses. But in Kali Yuga, the demon and devotee are living in the same body. The demon and the devotee are living in the same body. So, yeah, that's why we find that sometimes it's a little difficult to really advance nicely in Krishna consciousness, and sometimes we become attracted to Maya. So it's because we have this in us. I'm not saying any of you are demons. You're not, you're great devotees, but there are traces of the demoniac, or when we say materialistic, we mean demoniac nature, anti-Krishna, sense gratification. So Krishna says then in verse 6, now I'm going to tell you all about the demons. And then he gives an extremely vivid description of the demons. Very vivid. They don't like cleanliness. You can't find cleanliness in them. You can't find proper behavior. You can't find truth. They have all sorts of strange understandings about what this material world is. They may think it's unreal, that there's no real foundation to it, that there's no God in control, that reproduction is the essential thing that we should really concern ourselves with. Just like, I mean, you can see it so clearly in Darwin's theory. Darwin's theory simply means the progress of sex life, basically. how to progress through sex life. Evolution, one species evolving birth after birth. So it's just following in this principle, thinking sex life to be so important, such an important principle. Then in verse 9, they're so bewildered, it's so crazy, that they actually, they willfully engage in activities which are horrible and which are actually intended to destroy, like atomic bombs and things like this. It's completely crazy. Completely mad. They take shelter of lust. Verse 10. They're absorbed in pride, false prestige, even if they've got nothing to be proud of. Even if they're full of disqualifications, they'll be proud of something. They're attracted by the impermanent. Verses 11 and 12, as far as they're concerned, sense gratification is the goal of life. That's all. Eat, drink, and be merry. But what happens? As a result of that, they're in anxiety all the time. Because there's such intense competition. I want sense gratification and you want it. So we compete. One of us gets the sense gratification, the other doesn't. So much anxiety is there. Anyways, going on like this, the mentality of the classic demon is expressed in verses 13 and 15. So much wealth do I have today, I'll gain more according to my schemes. So much is mine now, it'll increase in the future more and more. He is my enemy and I've killed him. I'll kill my other enemies. I'm the lord of everything. I'm the enjoyer. I'm perfect. I'm powerful and happy. Very nice. This is the mentality of the demon. But what happens? Verse 16 explains. They go to hell. They fall down. Krishna explains in verse 19 that such demoniac people I perpetually cast into the ocean of material existence. One devotee, when Srila Prabhupada visited South Africa, one devotee asked Prabhupada, is it that everyone will go back to Godhead sooner or later? What do you think Prabhupada answered? No. Prabhupada said, no. You can stay here forever if you want. Whatever you want. If you want to stay, stay. Krishna will say, fine. If you want to go back to Godhead, Krishna will say, fine, come. Whatever you want. Prabhupada said that if you tell Krishna, I want to go to hell, maybe you wouldn't necessarily say exactly like that, but through your desires you showed that you were desiring hellish things. So indirectly you're saying, I want to go to hell. Then Krishna will say, okay, come on, let's go. And away you go. There you'll be in hell. And if you want to go back to Godhead, Krishna says, okay, let's go back to Godhead. So whatever you want. So if you're like a committed demon, as is being described here, you can stay here indefinitely until you decide that now I want to get out. So now I'll surrender. Until that time. Then Krishna will give you all help. Krishna is very kind in that way. So it's not that, you know, after so many umpteen zillion years, that Krishna is going to finally decide that all you guys who have, well, all the people who haven't gone back to Godhead are still committed to being demons, that he'll just rip them out of the material world and just send them back to Godhead anyway. No. That's another thing. Let us just, what should we do? Finish this chapter? Yeah, let's just quickly finish this chapter. So, what to be careful on, particularly, there are three things. Verse 21, Krishna says there are three things you have to be particularly careful of. Lust, anger, greed. You have to be particularly careful of those things. And how do you do that? You have to follow Shastra. In verse 23, Krishna makes the point that if you don't follow scripture, then you can't achieve anything worthwhile. You won't achieve perfection. You won't even achieve happiness. What to speak of the supreme destination? Then verse 24, the last verse in the chapter, you have to understand what to do. How? Through scripture. And then you can systematically act in such a way that you are elevated. So that's good. We finished chapters 15 and 16. For tomorrow, read chapter 17 and begin reading chapter 18. Oh, wait a minute. Yeah. Begin reading chapter 18. We may go a little way into chapter 18. Any last question or comment?
Here we talk about lust, anger, and greed.
Yes.
But you also said the spiritual greed
is a gateway. Yes. Well, This is talking about material greed. Don't get confused. Okay. Now for your test, you've got to learn what's on this piece of paper. If you haven't got one, I have a couple more here. Make sure you get one. You have to learn about the banyan tree. You have to learn about the Purusha and Prakriti and all that. Then you have to learn your four verses. Then I also want you to learn from the second half of chapter 9 and the first half or third of chapter 10 how Krishna helps those, how Krishna relates with his devotees. That would particularly mean, as described in chapter 9, verse 22, verse 30 and 31, and then the Chatushloki Bhagavad Gita, chapter 10, verses 8, 9, 10, and 11. How Krishna relates with his devotees. Or in other words, how bhakti yoga is really such a nice process, and it's even better than karma yoga, jnana yoga, and those other yogas. Okay, so we'll meet again tomorrow. Srila Prabhupada ki. Means that you accept the condition. If you accept a condition, that means you become conditioned. So you accept the condition of goodness, it means you become conditioned by goodness. So we're accepting the conditions of the different modes, so we're called conditioned. Then verses 6, 7, and 8 describe how each one of the modes conditions us. With its conditions. So what are the conditions of the mode of goodness? It's purer, it's illuminating. And what happens when you come under the influence of that condition, or you accept that condition? You achieve a sense of happiness and knowledge. Very nice. But it's not that nice. Sounds quite good. Very happy, knowledgeable. But look out. Look out. We become bound by goodness even. So our acharyas give a very interesting description of how one becomes conditioned by goodness, or what is wrong with the mode of goodness. There are some things which are very wrong with the mode of goodness. One is that it's material. That's of course the main one. It's not natural for us. But Vishnath Chakravarti Thakur says that there are two sins in goodness. Two sins. And what are those two sins? They're the very qualities that are referred to in this verse. Happiness and knowledge. In goodness.
He says they are the two sins of the mode of goodness. And he says that attachment to knowledge creates ignorance. Now, Baladev Vijayabhushan gives a more elaborate description. Part of it is, actually Prabhupada in the second paragraph of the purport of verse 6 is basically explaining part of it. So he says that a person in the mode of goodness is aware that he's above passion and ignorance. He's naturally aware because he's in knowledge. So what happens? He becomes proud. He becomes proud of his position above passion and ignorance. Then a very interesting thing happens. He's appreciating that this knowledge and happiness that I have in goodness is very nice, and I don't want to lose them. So what does he do? He works in order to maintain them. He makes efforts to maintain his happiness. He makes efforts to maintain his knowledge. So what does that mean? He's falling into passion. Because he's making an effort. He's working. He's making an effort to keep these things. So he's actually falling into the mode of passion. Because passion means you work in order to achieve a goal. So he says that the attachment, the happiness and knowledge, that's one thing. But the attachment that the person has, that is of the nature of Rajaguna. Isn't that interesting? It's one thing to have the happiness and to have the knowledge, but when you become attached to it, that attachment is of the nature of the mode of passion. So therefore, if he doesn't become attached to the spiritual platform, he falls down. So these are the two sins of the mode of goodness, happiness and knowledge. Then, verse 7 is a fairly clear description. Mode of passion is born of desire. Unlimited desires and longings. And because of it, one becomes bound to material fruit of activities. So the conditioning of goodness comes from the knowledge and happiness. The conditioning of passion comes from hankering and attachment. He's attached to two things, the fruit of the work and the work itself. Then verse 8 is describing the mode of ignorance. It covers everything. Mode of darkness covers everything. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says that the first characteristic of the mode of ignorance is a lack of enthusiasm. Then verse 9. When one is conditioned by goodness, one becomes conditioned to happiness. One feels too satisfied to bother with Krishna consciousness. Why do I need to bother with Krishna consciousness? Life's great. I'm happy, I've got lots of knowledge. Very nice. When a person's in passion, one feels one is too busy to take an interest in Krishna consciousness. And when you're in ignorance, you're too dull or too crazy to take an interest. Then section C is recognizing superiority or supremacy of a mode within a person, or, in other words, to recognize what modes a person is under, or to recognize what modes you're under. probably a more practical sort of application. So verse 10 states that the modes compete. Of course, it's not exactly that the modes compete, but what is happening is that your karma is changing. Your karma is being administered basically via the modes. So your karma is changing. So at one point in time, because of your karma, you're more under the influence of goodness, but then your karma changes, or not exactly your karma changes, but you come onto like another part of your karma starts to manifest, and it's of a different nature, so then another mode will influence you. So in this way, one's position in the modes tends to change. Although one will have like a main mode that one is influenced by. So, what is the manifestation of goodness? Knowledge. So in other words, if a person is very knowledgeable, that indicates that they are considerably influenced by goodness. Now, if a person is mainly influenced by passion, how will you recognize that? Verse 12 explains. Great attachment, always interested in fruit of activity, intense endeavors, and great desires and hankerings. And if a person is predominantly influenced by ignorance, how will you recognize that? Darkness, inertia, madness. Hope none of you are mad. And illusion. Hope none of us are mad. So these are the four main characteristics of ignorance. Now later on in chapters 17 and 18, there are further elaborations. Like, for example, if a person is in the mode of goodness, what sort of food will they be mainly interested in eating? And so on and so forth. So many different subject matters according to the modes. But this is just a little introduction. So, person in goodness, characteristic is primarily knowledge. Passion, it's primarily great attachment, fruit of activity, intense endeavor, and great desire and hankering. And the basic characteristics shown by a person in ignorance, darkness, inertia, madness, and illusion. Then verses 14 to 18 are describing actions and death. For persons in the different modes. So, verses 14 to 15 are describing death. If a person dies in the mode of goodness, that person will go to the higher planets. If a person dies in verse 15, if one dies in passion, then you'll take birth basically on the earthly planets, amongst those engaged in fruitive activities. It means basically in this realm. And when one dies in ignorance, you take birth in the animal kingdom or hell. Animal kingdom means hell. Or some other type of hellish situation. Then actions. In the mode of goodness. Piety. With correct vision. And it leads to life in heaven. Where's that stated? That's stated in 18. Action in the mode of passion results in misery. Action in the mode of ignorance results in foolishness. Then going on to, that's 16. Then going on to 17. What develops from each mode? From the mode of goodness, what develops is real knowledge. From the mode of passion, what develops is greed. From the mode of ignorance, what develops is foolishness, madness, and illusion. Then 18 again talks about destination. Destination of one in the mode of goodness, heavenly planets. Mode of passion, earthly planets. mode of ignorance, hell. So if you look at it mode by mode, in the mode of goodness, you can make a note of these things, because we're going to ask you about this in the test. In the mode of goodness, at the time of death, the person goes to heaven. The nature of the activities of a person in the mode of goodness, the nature is that they're very pure and pious. And what develops from the mode of goodness is real knowledge. So three headings: death, at the nature of the actions, and what develops as a result. So in goodness, death, you go to heaven. The nature of the actions are pure and pious. And what develops from the mode of goodness? Real knowledge. Then again, the mode of passion, under three headings: death, you take birth on the earthly planets. The nature of the activities, they cause misery. And what develops? Greed. Then, mode of ignorance. Time of death, animal birth or hellish birth. The nature of the activities of the person in ignorance? Foolishness. And what develops from the mode of ignorance? Foolishness, madness, and illusion. Did you all get that? Okay. So now we can go on and transcend the modes. Verse 19 to verse 27. This is what we need to know, really, ultimately, how to transcend the modes. So, 19 and 20, describing the importance of understanding all this and knowing that we and Krishna are transcendental. So there's no other performer, Krishna says, than the modes. So if we understand all this, and we know Krishna, then what do we achieve? Madbhava, my nature, spiritual nature, Krishna says. You become free from birth, death, old age, and disease, and you enjoy amrita, vimuktamrita. Ashnute. You enjoy spiritual nectar. Then in verse 21, Krishna asks three very relevant questions. How can you recognize a person who's transcendental? What are his symptoms? How does he act? How does he behave? And how does he achieve the transcendental position? It's one thing knowing about it, but how do you get there? So, verses 22 to 25 describe the symptoms and the behavior. So, symptoms. He doesn't hate illumination, attachment, and delusion when they're present, or long for them when they disappear. Unwavering and undisturbed through all the reactions of the material qualities, neutral, transcendental, knowing that the modes alone are active. Now, according to Prabhupada's purport, those are the symptoms, and everything from that point on refers more to the behavior. Basically, the symptoms go down about halfway through that translation. The last symptom is knowing that the modes alone are active. I mean, they actually sort of overlap to some extent, but in Prabhupada's purport in the second paragraph, he sort of makes this distinction between the first half of the verse, or the first half of the translation and the second half. So second half is more describing the behavior. Self-situated, looking on a lump of earth, a stone and a piece of gold with an equal eye, and so on and so forth. These are the activities or the behavior of a transcendental person. And verse 26 is answering the question, how does the person achieve that transcendental position? How? Engaging in full devotional service. This is a very famous verse indeed. Mam chiyo vyabhicharena bhakti yogena sevate sagunan samatityaitan brahma bhuyaya kalpate. One who engages in full devotional service, unfailing in all circumstances, at once transcends the modes of material nature, and thus comes to the level of Brahman. Now this Brahman that Krishna is referring to here is not the same Brahman that Krishna was referring to in verse, whatever it was, 2 or 3 or so. 3. It's not the same Brahman. Just that the term Brahman...